Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon. Yes. We're close to Canada. I'm on the north side of St. Paul. And good afternoon to those of you at home on the web. Hope you can join us soon. My title today is Hanging Laws. Kind of obscure title. I was hoping that it would pique a little interest. You've heard of hanging judges. Well, this is not about that. These are not laws to hang people by. But the word comes from the words of Jesus Christ in Matthew 22. I'll just quote it for you. You don't have to turn there. Matthew 22, 36. It's when the Pharisees asked Christ, Master, which is the great commandment? Very familiar with this section. Jesus said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And then he said, on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Interesting way to put it. They hang on these two principles. It's a pretty good translation if you look up the Greek word. It literally means to hang up or suspend. It's like a couple of big hooks on the wall, and the whole law and the prophets hang in principle on those two principles. I intend to hang some laws today, that is, to categorize some laws from the Old Testament, from the Old Covenant, and hang them on those two hooks today. Specifically, I'm going to use a subset of the law, which is the Book of the Covenant in the Book of Exodus. Now, you can pretty easily hang the Ten Commandments on two hooks. As you know, of course, the first four hang on the hook, love the Lord your God. And the other six hang pretty conveniently on love your neighbor as yourself. You know, God is love. That's the overriding principle, and it is. You can divide that into love of God and love of other people, as long as there are people on the earth. Eventually there will be spirit beings, and it'll be love for anybody besides yourself, including yourself, of course, but love of everyone. But what defines love? It's broken down further. What is love? I'd like to divide that second principle, love your neighbor as yourself, the way Jesus did in another scripture, Matthew 23:23, another famous scripture that you're very familiar with, where Jesus said, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have omitted the weightier matters of the law. Matters of the law. Now, these are things that are supposed to be found in the law. Judgment, mercy, and faith. So I want to hang the books. Well, not hang the books, I want to hang the laws within the Book of the Covenant on those three hooks. By the way, I've got a handout of all the references I'm going to cite today. And I put a little pile in the middle of each pew. So if you don't have that handout and you want one, it will save you scribbling down 100 scriptures. You can grab one from the center of the pew. The handout is divided into three columns. As the principle of love of neighbor is then divided into the two weightier matters of the law that Christ mentions, which would be justice. I think that is better translated fairness. For us individually, we are not judges, but we are to treat people fairly. And mercy, and again, we don't generally have to forgive anybody because we are not judges, and we don't have that many people to forgive. But mercy means much more than forgiveness. Mercy means kindness. God is gracious. God is kind in many different ways. So anyway, love of neighbor divides, according to Jesus, I think, into two columns, fairness and kindness. So if you want to put some scriptural references on the top of that, on top of those notes, the top line there, the divide into two is Matthew 22, 37 through 39 on the top line. And the second line down, where it divides into three, then it would be Matthew 23, 23. And by the way, you could also include easily in that division of three, Micah 6:8. Remember, that's a favorite scripture of a lot of people. Micah 6:8 says, "He has showed you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you?" And he names the same three things. To do justly, which is to be fair. To love mercy, which is kindness. And to walk humbly with your God, which is faithfulness. Obedience to God. So you can note Micah 6:8 on that line as a reference to the three columns as well. You should be able to hang all the laws of all five books of the law on those three principles. I'm just going to narrow it down to the basics today and take a little subsection of that. Right at the beginning of Exodus 20, we're going to scan Exodus 20 through 23. It's a section called the Book of the Covenant. God speaks the Ten Commandments, of course, directly to the people. A very loud voice, but the people couldn't bear to listen to it. Exodus 20 and verse 19. "And they said to Moses, speak you with us, and we will hear. But let not God speak with us, lest we die." It must have been a very frightening sound. And 21, "And the people stood far off. But Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was, which was on the mountain." And then God speaks the words of the Book of the Covenant to Moses. He only speaks to Moses, but the sound of his voice is audible to the people. Moses was not up in the mountain, but God was broadcasting that sound, and it was frightening the people. And the next 92 verses, what I want to cover today, the next 92 verses through Exodus 23:19 are what is called the Book of the Covenant. In fact, at the end of that section, Moses writes it down, and it's called the Book of the Covenant. So the book begins in Exodus 20 and verse 22. "And the Lord said to Moses, thus you shall say unto the children of Israel, you have seen that I have talked with you from heaven," which is almost totally unique. And how many times has God audibly spoken to more than one person? He spoke to the prophets. He spoke to individuals. I mean, there were people who heard his voice say, "This is my beloved son," at Jesus' baptism. There was a transfiguration where a few disciples heard the voice of God. But it's extremely rare for God to speak audibly to more than one person. He's speaking from Mount Sinai here in Exodus, so I would characterize this as the Old Covenant Sermon on the Mount. Right? God is speaking directly to the people from the mountain. This is the Old Testament Sermon on the Mount. It's interesting to compare it to the New Testament Sermon on the Mount. Anyway, law number one, principle number one in the covenant is Exodus 20, verses 23 through 26. They're in the notes there under column one, item number one, where he clarifies commandment number two about idolatry. In verse 23, he says, "You shall not make with me gods of silver or gods of gold, an altar of earth. You shall make unto me and sacrifice thereon your burnt offerings, but," verse 25, "if you lift up your tool upon it, you will have polluted it." Now, it seems from this that it's taken for granted that the people of Israel were going to offer sacrifice. There had been sacrifice, obviously, since the time of Cain and Abel. But God is not anywhere in this book commanding sacrifice. He's just saying if they do sacrifice, it should not be idolatrous. They're not to lift up a tool on stone to make this altar, lest the altar itself become an idol. But there are no other sacrificial rituals at all mentioned in the Book of the Covenant. I believe this is what Jeremiah is referring to leave your marker here if you haven't got marked. I'm going to turn briefly to Jeremiah chapter 7. Jeremiah says something relative to this. Jeremiah chapter 7, the people of Judah thought that God would not allow the destruction of Judah because they had the temple, and God was not going to allow the temple to be destroyed. But God says through Jeremiah in verse 7:21, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, put your burnt offerings unto your sacrifices and eat flesh, which is not a very clear translation. But if you look at a more modern translation, what he's saying is something like, put your burnt offerings under, I'm reading the King James. It'd be more like, away with your burnt offerings and sacrifices, eat them yourselves. You know, I don't care about sacrifice. He's not interested in offerings. Verse 22, he says, for I spoke not unto your fathers, nor commanded them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt, concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices. He doesn't speak to many people many times, but he spoke to all of them, and he said nothing about sacrifices, except don't make the altar an idol. Sacrifice and ritual were never the things that God really wanted. You know, he added them a little later as a learning aid, but what was really important to God were the three weightier matters of the law. Here through chapter 23 in Exodus. So in Exodus 21, verse 1, now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. These are, in other words, these are going to be the application of the Ten Commandments to the children of Israel, to the nation of Israel. They're going to be illustrations of the principles of hanging from these two, and I'm saying three hooks. We're going to hang laws from these three hooks, the three weightier matters of the law. Item number two, then, is verses 2 through 11. These are my divisions, by the way. You might improve upon them. But this is the way I divide the Book of the Covenant into 32 pieces. 2 through 11 deal with slaves and servants. Verse 21, verse 2. If you buy a Hebrew servant, 6 years he shall serve, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. I think it's significant that the first issue in the application of God's commandments is to his slaves, is about slaves or servants. People who hate the Bible might say, aha, you know, your God advocates slavery. What kind of a God is that? But the point is that God did not advocate slavery. He permitted it. He changed slavery to be a more humane and kind way of doing things. Israelite slavery was not permanent. It was not ownership of a person as in the nations around at that time. It was to be more like an employer and employee relationship. And in fact, it could be used in place of prison. If a person stole something and he couldn't pay it back, he could be sold as an indentured servant for a while. He didn't have to go to prison. But you compare this to the legal codes of that time or before that time. Take the legal codes of the ancient Babylonia, like 2000 BC, we have the record of the Code of Hammurabi. The Code of Hammurabi has especially harsh penalties for people poor people acting against the rich. I mean, the code protects the rich. Of the Code of Hammurabi's 282 paragraphs, the rights of slaves are the last five. But here, in God's law, it comes first, the rights of slaves. Particularly careful here to protect the disadvantaged class. Here the slave, also the sojourner, the widow, the orphan, and the poor. Verse 3 says, If the slave, if he came in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he were married, then his wife shall go out with him. So these are the laws of kindness to slaves. Verse 7 protects women. And if a man sell his daughter to be a maidservant, she shall not go out to work in the fields as the men servants. Verse 8, if she please not her master who has betrothed her to himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. This is not slave labor here, but it is an arranged marriage. You know, in the New Testament, Christ said that Moses allowed certain things because of the hardness of their hearts. He allowed divorce, for example. But it was not intended from the beginning. It was not ideal, perhaps, the Old Covenant. Not everything in the Old Covenant was ideal, but it was. But God made concessions in the national law to the culture of the times, to the ability of an unconverted people. But the Book of the Covenant was the Old Covenant, and it was the Sermon on the Mount of the Old Covenant. It contains, I would say, minimum standards. You know, at least do this. If you do less than this, it's a crime. A lot of these things are defined as crimes. The New Covenant raises the bar, doesn't it? Many places especially in the Sermon on the Mount, the bar is raised very high. So we need to think about these principles, but raise the bar even higher as Christ magnifies the law. But anyway, in general, this section, 20 verses 2 through 11, are examples of mercy or kindness to the disadvantaged class. So I hang them under column 3, kindness. Number 3, verses 12 through 14 differentiate between murder and manslaughter. Verse 13, if a man lie not in wait, you know, then I appoint a place where he can flee. But verse 14, if a man come presumptuously upon his neighbor, then it's murder. So these are laws of justice, right? Fairness regarding the life of a neighbor. They not only protect as a deterrent from committing the crime, they also protect the offender from an unjustly harsh punishment. Number 4 is verse 15. He that smites his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. That's a curious law. Is that an immutable law? If a child hits his mother or father, should he be put to death? You know, we might have experience with our own teenagers having certain attitudes at certain times in their life. If they hit you, should you kill them? You know, I probably have a hard time explaining that to the judge. But this is a law of the Old Covenant. You know, this is a national law for a nation. We're not under the Old Covenant. We're not the judges of a civil government. The principle of honoring father and mother, though, is fundamental to families. It's fundamental. It mirrors our attitude toward our Creator. So we need to think about how we apply this ourselves. We enforce it on ourselves. It is written on our own hearts. But it is indeed a very serious matter, isn't it? Because under the Old Covenant, it was a death penalty. It's extremely important. It's under fairness or justice. Number 5, verse 16. He that steals a man and sells him, if he be found in his hand, he shall surely be put to death. Well, this is kidnap for the purpose of slavery. It's effectively stealing a man's life. And the deterrent is very strong here because this is like murder. Again, it's justice. Cross this line and it's a crime worthy of death. Of course, in the New Testament, with the new Sermon on the Mount, the bar is raised much higher. Not even to hate your neighbor, let alone sell him into slavery. Okay, number 6 is verse 17. He that curses his father or mother shall surely be put to death. Very much like number 4 above. Protecting the family. So this is justice at the family level. I put it under the middle column, justice or fairness. What is fair? Number 7 is about bodily harm, verses 18 through 19. If men strive together, and one gets hurt, and he dies not but keeps his bed, then in verse 19, the other pays for the loss of his time. You know, this is justice for a crime. It's a deterrent, certainly. He has to pay, but it protects the offender from vengeance. It's compensation for the injury, not vengeance. So this is also on the subject of fairness, justice, middle column. Number 8, verses 20 through 21. It's about harming a slave. If a man smite his servant and he die, in verse 21, or if he continues a day or two. This is again the protection of that servant, protection of that servant class. You know, we've already seen that a certain type of slavery is permitted, but killing the slave was murder. The slave was a person. So I would categorize this, I would hang this under the third column. This is kindness. This is protection of the disadvantaged. Number 9, 20, verses 22 through 23 is about negligent harm to a woman. If men strive and hurt a woman with child so that her fruit depart from her and yet no mischief or serious injury follow, he shall be surely punished. This one is a bit obscure in my mind. Is the question whether the mischief that follows, is it a miscarriage or a premature birth? I think the weight of evidence seems to support a premature birth, but either way, if damage occurs, then there's a penalty to be paid. If any mischief follow, then you shall give life for life. If it causes a death of either mother or child, it is considered murder. There's to be a money penalty unless there is a death here. It is a principle of justice, again, deterrence, but not vengeance. It's a measure of fairness. Goes into the middle column. Number 10, verses 24 through 25, principle of an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Now, these are not literal, I don't think. We don't literally mutilate the defender, but the principle was to make the punishment equal to the crime. The crime was to be punished, that's fairness. On the other hand, the one who is punished shouldn't be punished more harshly than the crime that he committed. This is fairness. It goes under column, the middle column. Not too much, but not too little. Number 11, 26 through 27, is about injury again of slaves. If a man smite the eye of his servant, he was to let him go free for this, for his eye's sake. Again, what's that? That's protection of your servant, protection of your slave. This goes under the kindness principle. This is what Christ meant by justice, mercy, and faith. The mercy is kindness. And much of the law hangs under kindness. Number 12. Verses 28 through 32 is discerning between an accident and negligence. 28, if an ox gore a man or a woman, that he die. If the ox tended to push with his horn in time past, then the owner is to be put to death. This is negligence, death from negligence. It has to be discerned as to whether it was accidental or negligence. Protection of a neighbor's life and also the defender. So it hangs under fairness. For us, I mean, we enforce the same kind of principle on ourselves. Did we do damage? Was it our fault? Was it an accident? Was it our negligence? You know, we have to decide and treat people fairly. 13, 20, 33 through 36 is also this similar. This is accidental versus negligent loss of property rather than injury. If a man open a pit and an ox or a donkey fall in, the owner of the pit shall make it good. But, verse 35, if one man's ox hurt another's, if it be known that the ox has used to push in verse 36, then he shall surely pay ox for ox. This is justice for property. Same discernment between accident versus negligence. This is the kind of principle we have to decide on our own. Was it our negligence or was it not? What is just? What is fair? Chapter 22, number 14. Verses 1 through 5 is about theft. So the definitions of, again, loving your neighbor as yourself. What is fair? And what is kind? Well, stealing is probably not kind, and it's probably not fair. But what is the penalty for stealing? If a man steal an ox, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox. If a thief be found breaking up and he be smitten, the thief is injured. There shall be no blood shed for him. So there are lots of considerations here as to making the penalty a deterrence, but at the same time making it restitution and not vengeance, and issues of liability if somebody is doing something illegal. Anyway, the answer to theft is not prison, is it? Here in the book of the law, the Bible never prescribed prison for anybody. That doesn't fix anything. Anyway, these are laws, the 5 verses are laws about justice for theft. Number 15 is verse 6, about negligent destruction of property. If a fire break out so that stacks of corn are burned in somebody's field, he that kindles the fire shall surely make restitution. Pretty simple. Restitution, sort of like theft, goes under fairness. Number 16, verses 7 through 15. It's a responsibility for loss of property if that property is in another person's care. Verse 7, if a man deliver unto his neighbor money or stuff to keep and it be stolen, whose fault is it? What's fair? It goes on through verse 15, but these are all proper justice for property loss, so you hang them under a middle column. Applies to us. Yeah. You know, we might borrow something, and if we destroy it, what should we do? We should be fair. Enforce it on yourself. Number 17 is verses 16 through 17, which is it's a form of rape, a harm to neighbor, not love of neighbor, but form of stealing. Sense of stealing virginity. If a man entice a maid that is not betrothed, if she was married, then it's adultery, and that's a different story. But this is fornication. And lie with her, he shall surely endow her to be his wife. So the man, as the stronger party here, marries the woman. This is not a very romantic principle by our standards. But don't think about the man being a serial rapist and making the woman marry a serial rapist. Think about the boy next door. You know, this is a case of things getting carried away, and the boy next door has stolen her virginity. Now, in a male-dominated society, like under the Code of Hammurabi, they might decide that women are always the seducers, and so we kill the woman. But God's law does not work that way. He recognizes the loss to the stronger individual. He protects her. Now that she is no longer a virgin, she must be supported by this boy for the rest of her life. This I would put under the kindness column. This is, again, protection of the weaker party. Number 18, verse 18. You shall not suffer a witch to live. Now, witchcraft is another service in a sort of sense to another god, which would be a direct violation of the first commandment. Obviously a matter of faithfulness to God. This is disobedience. And the penalty is severe. In other words, keep far from it. Number 19 is verse 19. Whosoever lies with a beast shall surely be put to death. This is obvious, an extreme perversion of sexuality. The other forms of perversion of sexuality are not detailed as this extreme case, but I think this is obviously an extremely important matter. I would categorize it as damage to family, and the penalty was severe. This is just one of the far outer boundaries of breaking the law. But for us, the New Covenant prescribes much narrower boundaries. You know, even lust in the New Testament, Sermon on the Mount, even lust is adultery. Serious matter. Anyway, falls under fairness or justice, I think. Number 20 is verse 20. He that sacrifices unto any god, save unto the Lord only, he shall be utterly destroyed. Again, a direct breaking of the first commandment. Not that sacrifice was prescribed anywhere in the Old Covenant here, but certainly sacrifice to another god is a serious matter. It breaks the principle of faithfulness to God. Number 21, out of 32, we're getting there. Number 21 is verses 21 through 27, protecting the disadvantaged again. You shall not vex a stranger. You shall not afflict a widow or a fatherless child. If you lend money to the poor, you can't charge interest. This is protection of the stranger, the widow, the fatherless, the poor. And I think the principle of kindness goes far beyond the principle of fairness. I mean, as far as difficulty. You know, you can soon learn that you have to be fair. If you run a business, if you're not fair, you're surely going to lose your reputation, and that's going to be bad business. But God's law goes beyond fairness. It goes to helping those who cannot benefit in return. It's higher principle. It's harder to do. As James put it, mercy triumphs over judgment. I think that's what he meant. This is a higher, harder principle. This hangs in the kindness column. 22 is verse 28. You shall not revile the gods. Now that's an ambiguous translation. Some translations have it, you shall not revile God. In other translations, it's you shall not revile the judges, nor curse the ruler of your people. So it's a little ambiguous, but I think from the context, it should be the judges. You should not revile the judges or curse the ruler of your people. This is a respect for the national justice system, so I'd hang it under fairness, justice. Number 23, verses 29 through 30. You shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe fruits. And the firstborn of your sons shall you give to me. Now, that's a curious thing, but remember this book of the covenant was given before the Levites were chosen to be the priestly tribe. At this point in time, the firstborn sons were to be the priests. So this law was intended to support that priesthood. You gave your firstborn sons, and then you gave the firstborn of your oxen and your sheep. It's really the same principle as tithing. It is a support of the priestly class or the education and religious education of the nation. It's really the same principle as tithing. Tithing is not mentioned specifically in the Book of the Covenant, but we know tithing was already a principle in the time of Abraham, and this confirms it as a principle of paying to support the educational system of the nation. It's part of then faithfulness to God, whether it was tithing to Melchizedek, or tithing to the priesthood, or tithing to the church. It's a matter of faithfulness to God. So I would hang it under column one, faithfulness. Verse number 24 is verse 31. And you shall be holy men unto me, neither shall you eat any flesh that is torn of beasts in the field. How would you categorize that one? If you eat disgusting meat, is that showing love of God or love of neighbor? Which one is being violated there? It seems to acknowledge already that everybody knows that God has created certain things to eat, be eaten, and certain things are uncouth, are vulgar to eat. All that's been known for a long time before this time. What does it hurt? What does it hurt if you eat something vulgar or uncouth or self-destructive? Well, it hurts being holy. You know, he says, "You shall be holy men unto me." It's sort of like the third commandment. You don't bear God's name in vain. You don't do the unholy thing. So it hangs under column one, faithfulness to God, being holy. Chapter 23. Number 25 is verses 1 through 3. You shall not raise a false report. You shall not follow a multitude to do evil. Neither shall you countenance, or that is, show partiality to a poor man. These are underpinnings of justice, aren't they? Not to purge yourself, not to play politics, not to respect persons, whether they're poor or they're rich. Basic principles of fairness or justice. It goes obviously under column one, I think. Number 26, verses 4 through 5, is about who you offer help to. Who do you help? Verse 4, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, or you see a donkey of him that hates you lying under his burden and shall forbear to help him, you shall surely help with him. This is a very hard principle to follow, isn't it? As Jesus put it in the other Sermon on the Mount, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. It's clearly not new in the New Testament, was it? Because it's right here in the Book of the Covenant. Kindness even to the enemy. I'd say that falls under fairness. Maybe you should put it under kindness. I don't know. But it's one of the two. I guess I put it under kindness on your notes there. Kindness even to your enemy. Number 27 is verse 6. You shall not rest the judgment of your poor in his cause. And I would put this under kindness because it's a protection once again of the disadvantaged. Justice was not to be perverted in favor of the poor man because he was poor, but it's not to be perverted against him because he's poor either, in favor of the rich. It's to be even-handed. But it protects the poor, and this specifically not to wrest judgment from the poor. Number 28 is about bribery. Keep you from a false matter. Verse 8, and you shall take no gift, for the gift perverts the words of the righteous. Once again, this is a very basic principle of fairness. Bribes would favor, if bribes were allowed, they would favor the rich. Verse number 29, is verses 9 through 11. Again, about the stranger and the poor. You shall not oppress a stranger. And verse 10, in 6 years you shall sow your land, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie still, that the poor of your people may eat. The land Sabbath, in other words, was not just about resting the soil. It was about providing for the poor. So I'm hanging this one under kindness because it was for the benefit of the disadvantaged, even animals. You're supposed to be kind to animals. Number 30, verse 12. 6 days you shall do your work, and on the seventh day you shall rest. Looks like the fourth commandment, but then it goes on to say, that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your handmaid, and the stranger. So, well, first of all, the Sabbath is obviously a part of the Old Covenant. It was not invented with the sacrifices or rituals. The Sabbath, of course, existed from creation. Nothing to do with being added because of sins. Nothing to do with the tabernacle ritual. But in this context here, he adds the Sabbath is supposed to be a blessing to everyone. And so I would hang this particular verse under the third column, kindness. This is rest, the Sabbath as a rest for the stranger. Number 31 is verse 13. And in all things I have said to you, be circumspect and make no mention of the name of other gods. Obviously, this would be unfaithfulness to God, another violation of the first commandment. And lastly, verses 14 through 19, it's an outline of the holy days. Three times you shall keep a feast unto me in the year. Verse 15 says the feast of unleavened bread. Verse 16 says the feast of harvest, the first fruits, which is Pentecost. And then the feast of ingathering, which is tabernacle. So I think it's very instructive that right here in the book of the covenant, the holy days, like the Sabbath, are listed apart entirely from the ritual law, from the service of the tabernacle, or any of that. This is faithfulness. I hang this under the first column. This is faithfulness to God. The holy days. And this is the end, then, of the book of the covenant. Verse 24, verse 7 says, and he took the book of the covenant. Well, first of all, verse 4 says, Moses wrote all the words of the Lord. He wrote them down, and then verse 7, he took the book of the covenant and read it in the audience of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has said, we will do and be obedient. So here's the covenant being made. This is the covenant, the Ten Commandments and the Book of the Covenant. They agree to abide by it. And the whole Book of the Law is expanding on these principles, and the prophets are denouncing them for breaking these principles. I brought up Jeremiah's reference to what was really important to God, and I would like to turn back there in conclusion, back to Jeremiah chapter 7. Again, in Jeremiah's time, the people had lost sight of the weightier matters of the law. They trusted that they were going to be saved because they had the temple. But God says to them in 7:5, if you truly amend your ways and your doings, if you truly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if you oppress not the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, and shed not innocent blood in this place, either walk after other gods, then I will cause you to dwell in this place. Then you can stay here and be my people in the land that I gave your fathers forever and ever. In other words, if you want to align with God's will, do not walk after other gods. That's faithfulness. Execute judgment. Oppress not the stranger. Those are fairness and kindness. Then God will keep them in the land. Verse 22, for I spoke not to your fathers nor commanded them in that day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices. And God literally spoke to them. He said nothing about that. That's not important. There was nothing in the Book of the Covenant about sacrifices or outward symbols like phylacteries or rituals like circumcision. None of that is in the Book of the Covenant. But this thing I commanded you, verse 23, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people, and walk in you in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well unto you. Obedience to the weightier matters of the law. As God gave it to Micah 6:8 again says, what does the Lord require of you but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God? That is to adopt these standards of fairness, kindness, and faithfulness. I think in the end, God wants a family that really is in his image. I think there is no point from his point of view, in resurrecting a people to eternal life, if that person has not fully aligned their own will, our own will, with these principles.